and welcome to Manx Radio, where you're listening to our general election candidate interview series. I'm Amy Griffiths, and I'm our election producer here. This September, you'll decide who gets one of the two seats available for each constituency in the House of Keys. And to help you make your mind up, we're inviting all the candidates to take part in a 30-minute interview. Today, we're hearing from Michelle Hayward, who's standing in Russian. She's speaking to Phil Gorn.
Falcharugus, Rias Kaj and Sheas Feed. Today I'm talking to Michelle Hayward, who's defending her seat for the first time in the constituency of Russian. Let's start with a nice, easy, gentle lob question. Why do you still want to be an MHK and what's your motivation for standing?
I think public service is something that comes right from the heart, doesn't it? And my desire to sort of get stuck in and make things better and help fix things, I think, has been there for a while. And that was partly why I was onto the commissioners when I was as well. Obviously, I've been in the post for 5 years. And during that time, there's been a number of matters have crossed my desk. And there's still more work to do. I've been working really hard, both for the people of Russian and for the rest of the wider island as well. And there is still more to do. And I feel like you spend the first maybe 6 months to a year finding your feet and understanding where you are and what you can do and what powers you have. By the time you've got going on it, it almost feels like it's over too soon. And so still lots of ongoing projects, lots of things that need some attention.
And what would you say are your biggest weaknesses? What would you say are the things that you still need to work on, and how will you overcome those things as assuming you get elected for another 5 years?
My family would tell me the biggest weakness is actually I just work too hard and I put too many hours in. But, you find this, the job kind of almost takes over the amount of time that you have available in your life. And I think that there needs to be a little bit more balance in it, but I'm not sure how you do justice to it. It's a real balance against wanting to be really thorough in your reading and your research before you start offering an opinion or trying to direct policy. I think that was one of my big problems is trying to get that balance right and trying to be out more. I spend lots of time out in the constituency visiting various groups and attending events at the Erin Arts Centre and all sorts of things, and that's great, but all of that eats into your kind of your downtime as well.
And I mean, the basic question I'm going to ask now is why do we need MHKs? But the kind of the sub question to this is and how has your answer changed in the 5 years that between the first time when you didn't really know much about it? Mm-hmm. So why do we need MHKs?
So I think that there are lots of things. Government departments pretty much run their own little sort of fiefdom, their own little areas of responsibility, and they will carry on. It's like you set a machine going. They'll carry on ticking and working along it. And MHKs are really there, the people to provide some oversight into that and some policy direction and to help guide that and to look at things that are not working for the constituents and for the wider island and call a halt to them sometimes or change direction or pivot on them. And so I think we need to have some way that we as a society agree on what the way is forward. And that's what having all those collective voices in the House of Keys and then in Tynwald actually manages to do. We can discuss those things through, and that helps direct then the policies that will direct the departments. And those departments are the ones that have an impact on everything that we do every day of our lives.
You have a manifesto that was produced in 2021. We haven't as yet seen your 2026 manifesto, and I'm sure Russian voters will be awaiting that arrival with great interest. So all I can go on is what you said you were going to do 5 years ago. As infrastructure minister, you had the opportunity to deliver several of your 2021 election manifesto commitments, including sorting out waste management, building houses, shifting local government responsibilities to the Cabinet Office, improving parking and reducing speeding. How well do you think you did in delivering these?
So where do we get to? The waste strategy was written before I left the DOI. I'm not sure what the new minister has done with it. It had been out to, the principles have been out for consultation, and the waste strategy that was there. And under my direction, the waste strategy was going to be an all-encompassing waste strategy. So rather than just dealing with household waste, which is where government has always offered guidance before, this wasn't. This was about construction waste and business waste as well, because I've taken the view that, you know, waste is waste, and wherever it comes from, it is irrelevant. How we deal with it is what the strategy was designed to deal with. That's one of a number of things that have just stalled since I left DOI. I did leave with a big whiteboard full of things that I was going to deliver on. So parking review was done in Port St Mary. There was one to be launched in Douglas that Mr Wannenberger bought a petition for. And I believe all of that's been just stuck on the to-do list again as well for the new minister. Speeding, well, we tried speeding. We tried dealing with that. So I mean, I did say dealing with speeding because it is a particular issue, and there are parts of the constituency where speed is a particular concern for those residents. The consultation that I sort of forced the department into, because it wasn't really going to do a long drawn out consultation, but the consultation that worked its way around the island, and I went and visited every local authority that wanted to speak to me to talk about what were the speeding issues in their area. And so although it started out from the Tynwald resolution for 20 miles an hour in residential streets, it actually expanded that every local authority I spoke to was then telling me, well, but we want this down from 40 to 30, and we want this down to 20, and actually we don't see why we've got a delimited section here. And so actually it all became wider than just the original residential streets. So all of those consultations have been done, the data should have been analysed, and I did put in a question for the department to get that published, because I think that sets the groundwork then for speed changes that are around the island that reflect what those communities want.
And I suppose as a follow-up to that question, during your brief spell as Infrastructure Minister, you discovered, I expect, that there is a delicate balance to be struck between strong and decisive leadership and bringing the people with you. Do you think you got that balance right?
I think I got tripped up by the department, to be fair, because they started out with a... Tim Ward said 20 miles an hour. Okay, well, we've got a new way of publishing these now. Instead of writing reams and reams of paper, we can draw a map and we can put lines on a map. Okay, well, what do we do for consultation? 2 weeks, publish it, and then carry on. And that consultation had gone live before I even knew that it was about to go live. I knew it was on the horizon, but it was live before I actually knew about it. And it was quite clear that that was never going to be enough of a consultation for something that was this big. And as part of that, because it just became part of the routine work of the department, you'd go out to consultation and then you'd have a contractor lined up. So suddenly poles were being installed before, you know, whereas I'd pressed pause on a consultation and said, we do something better and more inclusive. And then poles started appearing, and you're like, it's because the machine was working in the background, doing the routine things that it would have done, and without any real kind of political awareness from the officers involved that actually this needed to be handled in a different way. So I feel a bit like it's not their fault. They were following procedures and setups that have been in place for years and years and years, but it all just timed out wrong, and it looked to the public like I was carrying on putting up poles even though, you know, we hadn't got an agreement, and that just wasn't true. I don't personally put up poles, obviously.
and well, I suppose on that subject then, I mean, is this a, well, I suppose, yes, it inevitably this is about experienced, you know, very, very experienced ministers would probably know that that's the kind of thing that happens in departments and they need to be all over it. Yeah. And I guess you've learned something from that experience.
Yeah, and I'd come into DOI having been in four other departments, and there have been you know, times, and you're not, I wasn't the minister, I was just departmental, but there have been times there where officers have carried on and done something that suddenly, you know, kind of comes round to bite you a little bit and you end up having to defend a position. So I kind of had seen it. I think this one, the DOI is so large as a department, as you know. It's got so many responsibilities across so many areas. You know, there's one slip anywhere and that's how everything gets badged. But actually, there were lots of other areas where things moved along smoothly and moved in the right direction. And, you know, we moved housing into the housing agency model rather than going down a £1.2 million set up a housing association like scheme and set the board going there. And actually, the what's come out of there since, the consultations about the changing in thresholds for access to public sector housing, all of that stuff is really, really overdue and really needed to be done. And watching that agency kind of take responsibility for doing those things, but with a clear political steer about what needed to happen. That's, you know, it's about how you structure the department. And some bits of it I managed to get round to changing and other bits not so.
And housing, I mean, everyone, as far as I could tell, who stood at the last election described a housing crisis.
Yep.
And pretty much everyone who stands at this forthcoming election can talk about exactly the same thing. I mean, you had a year as minister with the most influence over housing. And sadly, there are several ministers with some influence over housing, which is possibly why housing hasn't been built to anywhere near the extent that we might expect. But how many houses will be built as a result of your tenure?
Do you know, that's a hard one to say, hard one to quantify. So what we did manage to do while I was in DOI was we went out to the local authorities that have housing and asked them where the housing plan was. It's a statutory responsibility. They have one. Not many did, apart from Douglas and everywhere else was a bit kind of lax. And so that's focused them into, okay, we do need a housing plan. And I think that's helped focus local authorities into what they could do. So we've seen applications coming in Ramsey. And there were applications that were due to come in from Port Erin as well. We had a housing conference with the local authorities, explained the situation of where we were and what we were doing with housing and what was coming forward in the way of the access changes that we were talking about and that consultation. And that, I think, inspired a lot of local authorities to suddenly realise that actually, after years of sort of sitting there just managing a stock, that they could widen their horizons. And so I think you'll start to see that stuff come through, but it takes a long time for them to work up a scheme and to get agreement from Treasury for the loan to go with it. And, you know, so you won't see that appear straight away. And in fact, that work should have started right at the very start. And it's the same with the landlord regulations work that just never got picked up on. And as much as I was trying to drag people through to do it, that hasn't happened either. The department obviously holds Section 13 funds, so when somebody builds, if they don't include affordable housing, they can pay a sum towards it. But when I asked the question of how do we spend this, the answer was, well, we don't really have anyone doing development. So actually, there is a housing development officer there who's going around and looking at the opportunities, looking at land, looking at buildings, looking at what we can do, because we do have that money there to be spent on housing. So I think it was starting to move things in the right way, but these things do take time to come through. So I think I achieved a reasonable amount, but actually that stuff should have been done much earlier in the administration in order to have some effect.
And again, you know, the public will just see that Isle of Man government has not really built any houses, despite there being a housing crisis. And in your manifesto from 2021, you talk of financial processes in particular, and basically saying private businesses just wouldn't work that way.
No.
How is it that, well, why is it that the public sector ends up wrapping itself up in so much red tape and bureaucracy? What is the reason for this?
I think this almost, to my mind, it almost feels like a sense of fear. You know, so every time anyone sits there and shouts about, I want accountability, actually, I want names, what they're actually saying is, I want you to sack somebody. And I think that's a ridiculous way to manage any organisation. You know, we all make mistakes at times, and what we don't expect, unless it's something really, really super critical, we don't expect that we'll get sacked for making a mistake. But I think you go back to things like the Liverpool ferry terminal and where the costs started to escalate on those and where the controls were over that and who agreed that at the time and how much Tim Ward was told when it was clear that things were going off track. And it was one of the first things we were asked to talk about when we came in after the election, was to agree that the budget was going to be increased for that. But there was, you know, a lot of that had happened during the period where Parliament had dissolved, and so those things were all going awry. And I think as a result of that, there's almost been a switch the other way. So now things are going through Project Management Unit, then they're going through the Major Projects Board, then they're going for the Strategic Assets Committee, then they're going through Treasury Board, then they, you know, they're coming, there's layers and layers of extra checks going on. And we've just seen, you know, with the case for the horse trams, that Treasury then loaded, you know, £1.2 million of contingency onto a business case that was £1.8 million to start with. And I'm not sure that we're making the right risk assessments when we're doing things like applying those contingencies. And I'm not sure still of the value of all of those stages in our project approval, because I don't think that the right advice and the right assessments are being made at each stage. When I've been trying to help local authorities with the petitions process, you know, that all comes through DOI. DOI faffs around and sends it to different places and eventually presents it all to Treasury. And I'm just like, I'm not sure of the value that all these people having input onto this are actually making other than to slow things down. And local authorities will tell you how frustrating it is that that's slow. Now, we do need to be careful and diligent about how we spend public finances, whether it's from the rates and through local authorities or whether it's government and taxation. Absolutely, we've got to be careful about that. But we also need to be smart about how those assessments are done. And at the moment, I think we've just layered more and more people having a voice without actually thinking, what does a clear and accountable process look like here? What does each stage actually add in terms of scrutiny value? So it's one of those things. I think what we've done is we've slowed down construction on the island massively. The construction industry will tell you there's no longer a pipeline of things coming through. We've almost killed our own construction industry by being so reticent to get on with the capital schemes that we know we need.
And knowing all this is one thing. What are you doing to change that?
Some of the changes actually will come through. We've just recently passed in Tynwald the changes to the budget process to give Tynwald a far greater role in how the budget is set, how it's formulated, the ability to amend the budgets. You know, this is a phenomenal level of change coming through. I think that will force changes within Treasury. How do you change things other than that? It'd have to be the next Treasury Minister to kind of start unpicking some of that stuff. I had started work with Alex Allenson while he was in post to look at the local authorities petition stuff. And we had a meeting lined up where we were pulling in everyone who has their fingers on over those documents to say, how does this process improve? Because at the moment, we don't know what value anyone is adding to it. But that meeting obviously never happened once we were both chucked out of office.
Going back to your 2021 manifesto then, I counted around 42 commitments, but you may have found, think it's more or less, I don't know. But of these, I reckon 7 have been delivered, 18 are at best work in progress, and 17 either no progress or actually the opposite of what you'd hope for. Why should people believe that another 5 years of Michelle Hayward will be any different?
I think all of us, especially those of us that go in as independents, you know, our manifesto is a kind of what we would do if we were Queen of the World kind of pitch, isn't it? It's you know, and it shows the people that are electing you the way that you would think about things and the bits that you think are things that need looking at, and so the challenges that you can foresee. We all know that none of us can deliver any of those things in isolation. We have to convince other people to go along with us. And, you know, if you're not part of the new council of ministers and setting the new version of the island plan or whatever it gets called next time round, it's unlikely that all of your hopes and dreams will be pulled into that. And some of them you can try and address by other ways. Some of them you can try and you know, work on the whoever the minister ends up in that area and try and see if you can get it through, or you bring a private members bill or whatever it is. But we work as a consensus parliament. And so I don't think any of us, if you picked up any of the manifestos from last time, I don't think any of us would be able to say we delivered even, you know, half of them fully or partly. And actually, if you get to halfway, that's probably a reasonably good achievement, I think.
Are you good at building consensus, working with others, team play and all that sort of thing?
Yes. that was a qualified yes, wasn't it? And I think very quickly and I'm very good at making decisions. And then sometimes what I forget to do is bring people along with me and take them on the same journey as I've just thought through to see whether we land at the same places. But I think certainly during my time as minister, you know, there were quite a few reasonably challenging and heated discussions around various topics. And I had Mr. Hooper and Ms. Farragher in the department and Mrs. Kinnish. And so, you know, sitting there talking through some really difficult policy decisions. Yeah, I think, you know, I am good at doing that. But it's, you know, sometimes events overrun you and the public has made a decision before you've actually had the chance to present your case. And I think that's also a problem within government, because you see somebody, you know, you make some vague aspersion on Facebook based on misinformation, and it takes 3 days for the government comms section to say, well, actually, hold on, no, that's not true. And so you've started out on the wrong premise. By then, somebody set up a petition and there's 400 signatures on it, and you're like, yes, but you all still started out on the wrong foot, and you're almost playing catch up all the time. And that's the bit I find that frustrating.
You've been pushing for a general ban on tobacco products, a generational ban, I should say, on tobacco products such as vapes. In your manifesto, you said we should target the Isle of Man's poor health indicators, and those included tooth decay, heart disease, alcohol and drug abuse and obesity. So what's next for generational bans? Alcohol, sweets, sugary drinks?
No, I think all of those things have a social acceptance and stuff like that. Obviously the attitudes to alcohol have changed. If you look at the attitudes now to drink driving compared to where they were 30 years ago, you know, there's a significant shift has happened there. And I think it's about recognising those harmful behaviours. So I think the same, you know, the drug policy needs to focus on dealing with drug harms, not, you know, I'm in favour of having whatever mechanism we get, a discussion about how you regulate access to drugs. But the drug harms aren't addressed at all by criminalising people and making them, you know, at odds with the government and the administration. So I think you need to embrace that. The generational ban on tobacco, I think it comes at a long end of a series of interventions. And so if you... Public Health gave evidence to the committee about this. There's what's known as the Nuffield Ladder of Interventions. And you start out with education. And that's what everyone always says. Oh, we'll do some more education. But we've done education for years. And then you move to doing sort of imagery. And then you move to changing the market or restricting marketing. And so you go through gradually increasing that level of intervention until you get to a point where you say, actually, it's just not safe. And there are no positive benefits to smoking tobacco. It's just, there isn't any at all. Whereas there are, depending on what research you look at, you know, a low level of alcohol intake is probably not bad for most people and probably quite nice for most people. So the level of harm is not the same at all. So I think you have to, you know, you do have to take an evidence-based approach to looking at what the harms are and then work out where your interventions are going to come. So I do think, I mean, the Smiling Man programme has been, you know, reinstated and you know, we have the worst decay record in five-year-olds compared to the poorest bits of the UK. That's really unfortunate. On an island that is an affluent island, we must be able to do better.
Well, we're zipping through this interview. There's loads more I could ask you about at your time in the House of Keys, but let's move on to what would you say your top three things are that you'd want to change in Russian?
In Russian, I would. We absolutely need more housing. Port St Mary is very constrained geographically. Port Erin does have more space and more scope. You know, but there are pockets of land there that we could be redeveloping. And the standard of housing, I think, for some of the local authorities is below where we need now. And what we know is that we have, you know, 16% of our population live in poverty and 16% are in social housing, but they're not the same group that overlaps. And so I think there needs to be a shift towards getting people who live in poverty out of expensive private sector rental. So that would happen at a national level, but I think it would have a big impact on Port St Mary. And on Port Erin too. And then when we look at the social housing that we have, it's very old, it's very inefficient in terms of thermal insulation. And that drives people who are already on low incomes further into fuel poverty as well. And there's a whole sort of fix there that we need to be looking at the how our housing infrastructure supports the people in Port St Mary and Port Erin and then in the wider sort of Ballyfeston area as well.
And on a national level, if you were successful and you got elected, what's the thing that, the most important thing that people should judge you on over the next 5 years? What's the thing that you will, you know, if I haven't achieved that, then actually I don't deserve another term?
There's so much, isn't there? There's so much that needs to be done. You know, we haven't got Manx Care to bed in properly as an operating system yet. I had long discussions with Manx Care and with the Southern Group practice, and there's, you know, going to be an expansion of services down south. And I think getting that primary care right, getting health care so that it's there available in your local area when you need it, and that you can get an appointment with the doctors. We've almost solved the dentist issue, but not quite, but it's close. But getting healthcare right, I think, has got to be the thing, so that none of us feel like I'm not feeling great, but I'm not going to bother trying to call the doctor because it's 6 weeks away. Because actually, all that does is put off that people who tend to be reticent about coming forward with health will present at a time when the treatment is going to be harder to be effective, and it's going to be more costly. And all we're doing is storing up those health issues. So we do have to get that access to healthcare right.
I don't know, is this a trick question or not? Which MHK past or present would you say has inspired you?
Oh, Hazel Hannon, absolutely. I feel privileged to know Hazel. Actually, she's given me a lot of advice over the years, and so and obviously we've got the Pride Film Festival coming up. We're showing No Man Is an Island, and you know that reflects on all of the work she did at the time, and just the bravery to take through the legislation that she did. So absolutely.
And we now just have a couple of minutes left. Tell us in a nutshell why people should vote for you.
So I'm hardworking, I'm honest, I'm open and willing to talk to anyone about anything, and I'm willing to tackle the hard decisions and do so from an evidence base. There'll never be a kind of, you know, I've just made a decision on the fly. It'll always be with consideration of the evidence and balancing up all the costs and the benefits, the disbenefits and the gains to be had from something. So I will always take, you know, reasoned, logical decisions.
And you've obviously enjoyed the first 5 years.
Enjoyed, yes, in a strange statistic way. There have been times that have been really challenging, there have been times that have been really exhilarating, and there have been times where you get up in the morning and think, I can't do this job, and then by lunchtime you've realised it's okay because you've started to unpick the problem, and the challenge is great. Every day is different, and every day brings its own challenges, but yeah, it's been thoroughly rewarding. It's been an absolute privilege to serve Rushen.
That was Michelle Hayward, who's standing for election in Rushen. Also standing in the constituency on Thursday the 24th of September are Michael Crowe, Mark Kemp, Lawrence Vaughan Williams and Simon Williams. This interview, along with all the others recorded as part of this series, will be available shortly after broadcast from your usual podcast provider. And as always, head to manxradio.com, where you can find everything you need to know about the general election on our dedicated website.